my rights away. The faster I will run, you can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong.
Singer, songwriter, musician, and poet Labi Siffre with Something Inside So Strong. He wrote the song in 1984 after seeing a documentary on apartheid in South Africa and released it as the B-side of a single also titled Something Inside So Strong in 1987. This is Utrice Lead, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. An information-packed program today, so let's get started. Vice President Mike Pence yesterday cast a history-making, tie-breaking vote that confirmed as Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, one of President Donald Trump's most controversial cabinet nominees. Pence's vote came after two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, joined a unanimous Democratic vote against DeVos, prominent philanthropist who twice served as chair of the Michigan Republican Party. DeVos admitted at her contentious nomination hearing that she has no experience in education policy or administration. But Trump has said DeVos's vision for a revamped education system is where he knows her strength lies. We have a couple of people who will be joining us to decode the significance and certainly the consequences, the likely consequences of the confirmation of Betsy DeVos. And we start with Dr. Thomas Pedroni, an associate professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology and director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. And thanks so much, Thomas, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us on, Utrice. Always love to be a part of your show.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I know, as I said to you when we talked, I said, I know I'm in mourning, and I'm sure you are too. Are you?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, my job is to also point the way forward and look for silver linings, right? But I think we do need some context, and it really means something when when you point out that she was controversial among Trump appointees, because the folks he nominated as a whole couldn't be more controversial, and she's a standout among that crowd. So that really says something powerful to me. So the first silver lining for me is that people became so involved in opposing her candidacy. Apparently, not only was the Mike Pence vote tiebreaker unprecedented, but so was the way that the Senate phones were basically shut down, the fax machines were shut down by people calling in to express their extreme concern. It seems like something really touched a nerve of the U.S. as a whole, including not just those of us who have been most afflicted in public schools and urban centers, but kind of across the board. And so there's some silver lining in there, in that I see people being mobilized. I have to jump right in and talk about another silver lining, and that is this, Utrice. Beatrice is a cousin, but anyway, you feel like family to me. Maybe that's it. But You know, in the closing days before yesterday, before Betsy DeVos received final Senate confirmation, folks like Eli Broad, including Eli Broad, who has been a central part of the decimation and dismantling of public education in our country, also came out strongly against Betsy DeVos. And I think the piece of good news that I see in that is that that Betsy DeVos has been a very divisive figure within the mainstream, if you can call it that, educational marketization, or what they like to call education choice movement. And so I'm very happy to see those edges exposed. Not only Eli Broad, but also one of the main financiers of Teach for America, can't think of his name right now, but also came out in the last few days against Betsy DeVos. And what I would have said, and what some of us did say to some of the Republicans to try to think inside their heads and why they should oppose Betsy DeVos was, look, what the charter movement really needed right now was not someone divisive like Betsy DeVos, but they needed a much more so-called mainstream advocate. Remember that the neoliberal coalition around education is very broad. It goes all the way from, you know, Democrats like Arne Duncan, locally Jennifer Granholm was the first to appoint an emergency manager. A lot of the foundation folks, including Eli Broad, call themselves Democrats. There's been a broad neoliberal consensus that ran all through the heart of the Democratic Party and through most of the Republican Party all the way to the far right, including DeVos and the religious far right. So that has been fractured to some degree. And I see that as an encouraging sign. Those folks used to walk in lockstep. And what they basically, the charter movement has been reeling, I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, they've taken on some blemishes. They used to have this shiny veneer about them, the charter school movement. It just seemed like it must be good. It's market-based. It sounds so slick. And there have been meaningful exposés of fraud, corruption, failure in the charter industry all across the U.S., including in Michigan. And so the charter movement has been in a bit of a reactionary moment where what they really needed was a mainstream proponent who would at least speak up for nominal regulation of the charter sector to restore some of that sheen, to give it back some of the legitimacy that it mistakenly held before. And they didn't get that. And I think that's why folks came out so strongly, even from that direction. We've got to see that as a hopeful moment, that was a powerful coalition that did a lot of destruction. And, you know, at least now there's internal division there, and that provides some new opportunities for us.
Well, we've been talking about Detroit a lot, where you have done a lot of work with regard to education. In fact, your very first book used that your experience in Detroit to discuss the targeting of inner cities with something that looked like a major plan was afoot. Is it just coincidental because DeVos is a Michigander? She is being she has footing in her home state, and it is as good a place to start because she has much support there for what she's going to be doing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I just wanted to find out from you whether this actually proves the theory we had begun discussing so quite a while ago, that Detroit in many ways is was a harbinger of many things to come, and this looks like one of them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one way you can look at it is, wow, Detroit has been such an absolute failure in terms of what the state, in concert with the Betsy DeVos's of the world, the privatizers, have wrought upon it. And you would think that they would see that and not confirm her. Another way to look at it is that they see what happened in Detroit as a tremendous success for their interests, right? I mean, none of us accepted that they were really that interested in helping low-income black and brown folks learn and be successful. To the degree that they were interested in at all, it was because they saw the dollar signs within black and brown, the way that black and brown bodies have almost always been treated in this country. There was a fortune to be made there, you know, at about $8,000 per student, if you could get your hands on it. And destroying public schools, pushing people into charters and other places are all ways to turn public dollars over to private hands. And Betsy DeVos has been an architect of that. And I need to point out that, by the way, that it's still going on. Her legacy is a very active legacy, still in Detroit to this day. And I'll say what I mean by that. Right now in Detroit today, you know, we have 38 schools across the state, and Denise Baldwin, who I hope joins us soon, is from Saginaw, where there are three schools threatened. But in Detroit, there are 24 regular public schools and one charter school that are threatened with closure by the state reform office. And Betsy DeVos figures in this in a number of ways. The first is that an opinion, a legal opinion, was issued by Miller Canfield that Governor Snyder originally accepted. And it was that, you know what, these schools can't be closed down by the state reform office this year because the district was just restructured. And the district is, for the first time in a long time, on some relatively firm footing. You know, the first thing I would point out is that the state-caused debt has been removed, largely removed from DPS. Now they call it DPS Community District or DPSCD, so that the first $1,200 of each student's per pupil funding towards their learning no longer goes to debt service, no longer goes to the creditors. You know, finally, some of the damage that the state has done to the district has been removed. And at this very moment is when they want to basically deal a death blow to the district by closing this year a quarter of the remaining schools, and then likely 25 more next year. That will put us, the district will have declined by 50% in just 2 years' time. That's after the district had 300 schools going back just 15 years ago. Now it would be down to around 50 schools if those closures take place. So this is something that's happening right now. Right now, Helen Moore, one of our heroes, I think, on this show, is at a press briefing, or I just let out, where Governor Snyder and state reform officer Natasha Baker were to appear at one of the schools that was slated for closure, Detroit Collegiate at Northwestern, I believe is its name. We don't know what they were going to announce, but for people outside of the Detroit area, basically not only did our reform officer announce that these 24 schools would be closed, and by the way, they'd be closed for 3 years straight poor performance. Right at the moment, I mean, the state has been in control of these schools under emergency management for the last 8 years, and under state management, some form of state management, largely for the last two decades, for 15 of the last 18 years. So now that the public schools have been decimated, the state wants to also come in and be accountable, you know, hold the schools accountable by closing them down en masse. I have to mention, too, that the state reform officer, Natasha Baker, is someone who is a ghost charter operator. And what that means is that, like many across the nation, she received funding from the State Department of Education that came through the U.S. Department of Education to establish a charter school. She received $110,000, and the school never opened, and we don't know what happened to that money that Natasha Baker received. But nevertheless, she is the agent of Governor Snyder, and she not only announced the closure, the likely closure of all of these schools, she says that she needs to make sure that students wouldn't experience undue hardship, whatever that could mean in a context of so much hardship already, if the schools were closed. But she already went ahead, and I think in a rather rogue fashion, even by Snyder administration standards, sent letters to all of the parents of children who attended these schools to be closed, advising them their school was likely to be closed and that they should be thinking about options elsewhere and even pointing out what some of those options were.
You had made very accurate predictions about where the issue of public education was going. Your first book, Market Movements, African American Involvement in the School Voucher Reform. To what degree do you see your premises in that book now verified to an undeniable degree with the appointment of Betsy DeVos?
So in that book, I was basically highlighting the ways in which there were actually supporters, some of them quite savvy, in particular African-American communities that were fighting for vouchers. And what I was pointing out in that book was how the very conditions that basically laid waste to public schools created the conditions for just about anything else to seem attractive to African-American families. And I was very interested in the alliance of far-right foundations like the Bradley Foundation, which helped to fund the Bell Curve by Herrnstein and Morey, which basically argued, it was a pseudoscientific book arguing that African-Americans and Latinos were inherently biologically, intellectually inferior to whites and Asians. So the foundation that helped to make that book so was suddenly very interested in aligning itself with African-American activists who had been activists around education, many of them going all the way back to the civil rights movement. And what I wanted to hear was if African-American voucher supporters in their concerns about the state of public education really shared a lot of the central ideas of those who were funding them. And of course, what I found out was that wasn't the case at all, that African-American folks who were supporting vouchers, you know, basically looked at it as, you know, anything to get ourselves out of these public schools that have been so horribly defunded. And they didn't have any of the vitriol towards public school teachers or even public schools or unions that their free market and further right supporters did. How do I think that's relevant to the current moment? Well, I think that, again, you know, that the era that I was speaking about is at least 15 years past from that book. Now, there is not nearly as much advocacy among African Americans for charter or vouchers, but nevertheless, the image of market-based educational reform, whether we're talking vouchers or charters or virtual schools, whatever, is always an image in blackface. It's always an image of this is social justice for African American or Latino children. So if you look at any of the billboards around Metro Detroit for this and this virtual academy, and we know that virtual academies have abysmal success rates, that they're just basically big money grabs of black, you know, the wealth attached to black bodies, that the faces are always smiling black boys who, you know, were to believe that they will benefit tremendously from these schools. So indelibly now, the impression is that the DeVos is looking out for children in Detroit. That's who she's really concerned about. So that aspect of it, I think, is still very much there, this idea that they are helping urban children, so-called.
M. Denise Baldwin is the lead voice against school closures and lead defender of public education in the state of Michigan. I'm so delighted that you are with us today. By the way, I'll just sneak this on you. We're starting this discussion today. It will continue. So thank you so much for being with us. You just heard Tom say that you were attending a news conference. What was it for?
News conference is happening in Detroit.
Oh, in Detroit, right?
Yes, with Helen Moore, right.
What do you know about what is being discussed there?
Well, I was, I'm not there, and I'm from Saginaw fighting this fight on in that part of the state, but I was at a planning session, an emergency meeting that was held in Detroit just this past Sunday, and there was a packed house of people, you know, ready and willing to fight and push back. And I know that there is a scheduled press conference with Natasha Baker and possibly the governor. And there was a plan for the community to show their opposition to the moves that are being made by the governor's state reform office. And so as far as what is happening there, I'm anxious to know myself, but I don't at the time.
Do you see any connection between the appointment of Betsy DeVos and the fact that so far this whole thing is starting out with a decidedly Michigan accent?
Well, yeah, I definitely see a connection. You know, whereas the country is just being introduced to Betsy DeVos in Michigan, we've lived under the impact of her and her family's influence for years. You know, even before her appointment and before her recommendation to be appointed, she was a name that those of us who are fighting to defend public education in Michigan were very well aware of, with the dollars that she's put into legislation and various foundations and organizations that have helped to destabilize our public schools.
Could you talk about the degree to which that campaign has been successful in Michigan? How many schools lost? How many schools closed? How many students literally farmed out into a whole different system?
Town's probably better able to talk about it on the statewide piece as far as how many schools have been closed. In Saginaw, I know that we have had a number of schools that were closed. And the thing about it is that they weren't directly closed by her, but a lot of the influence, when the 1280C legislation came into play and they were able to use standardized tests in a way that would rank our schools and put sanctions and punishments on them for the way that they score, that laid down a foundation for them to be able to come in and classify our schools as failing and take over for that. There was even a period where districts such as Saginaw Public Schools were scrambling to meet deficit elimination demands that were made from the state. And in order to do that, one of the quickest ways for a district to show that their budget is meeting this demand to get rid of their deficit is to close schools. And so some of the closures have not been directly laid out and recommended by the state as they are now. I believe that if the state moves ahead with closing the 38 schools, this is an unprecedented move from the state. But they have been able to, you know, still move their muscle through emergency management and some of the other demands that have been in place.
Yes, we saw that and recovered the whole process of the imposition of bankruptcy, actually, on Detroit. But in any event, I think we could see, with a little bit of hindsight here, the connections now that are becoming more exposed. It is not accidental that these school districts that were in such distress were also in areas that were declared bankrupt and put under emergency management. And they were, almost all of them, in fact, I would say all of them, were predominantly black cities and towns with black leadership. People had raised questions about that this is a very disturbing pattern, and now we see why. Services were severely reduced. You had people burdened with onerous taxes as a way of trying to drive them out of their towns and cities. And, of course, one thing you do when you want to destroy a neighborhood is you aim at the schools. So this was a coordinated program. Who is yes. Bessie DeVos that she was so influential in some of the decisions that were made connected to some kind of a fiscal effort to put these beleaguered cities back on track?
Tom?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I want to say is, first of all, I'm going to talk about how Bessie DeVos is directly related to the school closures across the state, including in Saginaw. And then I want to talk about and hear Denise talk about how one of our projects in fighting the closures and exposing the racist nature of them is to also unify predominantly African-American communities around the state where schools have been targeted for closure, with Saginaw being one of them. So first, DeVos and this specific round of closures. Okay, so there are 38 schools across the state that are slated for closure this year. 24 are regular public schools in Detroit. One is a charter school. But there are also three schools in the Saginaw area. There are two or three schools in Benton Harbor, in Kalamazoo, in East Detroit. And one of the things
Pontiac.
That some of our researchers, Pontiac, and by our researchers, I mean, you know, Denise herself working with Russ Ballant, is that they were able to verify that all 38 of the schools slated for closure are predominantly African-American schools, even if they're in communities that might not bring African-American folks to mind right away for most people, like Kalamazoo, for example, or even River Rouge. But so Bessie DeVos's involvement. As I mentioned before, the governor had basically concurred with an opinion that was issued by Miller Canfield that Detroit public schools should be exempted this year because the district has just been restructured and is finally able to, you know, in the words of market folks, compete on an equal footing against charter schools. But the DeVos-funded legislators are the ones who pushed Snyder to have his attorney general, Bill Schuette, reconsider that opinion and rule that Detroit schools were on the chopping block after all. So there's, first of all, direct DeVos, continuing influence on what is happening in Detroit. But I want to talk, too, about the fact that when folks think of Michigan, they might think of Detroit and Flint as African-American cities that are well known in the public imaginary, that have been decimated under emergency management. Flint also with the water and the lead and the poisoning of 100,000 people. But we have predominantly African-American communities all across the state. And invariably, those are the districts that are most targeted. I mean, the mechanism for this is, of course, a mechanism that largely was born under the Arne Duncan administration during the Obama years, beginning with Race to the Top in 2009, where districts that were hard hit after the financial collapse of 2008 and were in desperate need of funding were made to compete for relatively small amounts of funding. The 50 states competed against each other, and even states that were not successful in their bids, like Michigan, revamped many of their laws in accordance with what Arne Duncan wanted to see in those Race to the Top applications. And they were all things that had absolutely no basis in research at the same time that he was saying we need to do, you know, all research-based practices. Absolutely nothing to do with them, but that conformed to a fundamentalist market vision of public sector reform and one that was likely to benefit a lot of private interests who were very eager to get their hands on public monies. So that created that Race to the Top environment, which Michigan lost. Michigan nevertheless put into place both the State Reform Office, which used to be under the Michigan Department of Education, but Snyder felt like he didn't have enough control over it there because there is an elected State Board of Education governing the Michigan Department of Education. So he moved it directly under, I believe it's the Office of Budget and Management or something like that, directly under his control. So not only is there this entity, the State Reform Office, that is under his direct control, but But at the same time, in 2009, the state created the beginning of the top to bottom list, which basically measures where the bottom five, which schools are the bottom 5% in terms of academic performance, measured almost exclusively through standardized tests that the state requires, right? Now, one thing we know about those standardized tests is that they don't measure how hard students worked or how talented teachers were or how visionary administrators were or how much parents and communities supported their students. What they largely measure is what is the socioeconomic well-being and previous educational attainment of the families that are sending kids to a particular school. And so what this becomes when one shuts down the bottom 5% schools, and the formula for the 38 schools that are slated is apparently that they were in the bottom 5% for the last 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, it's basically saying, you know what, the schools that are struggling in the most difficult circumstances with the students who need a school with stability the most are the ones that should be closed down and called failures. Why are they failures? They're failures because they serve those who are most oppressed within the state, African-American, and in some cases Latino, low-income students. And so if you look across those 38 schools that are threatened for closure this year, you get a pretty clear picture of who is under the boot of the Snyder administration. Flint, obviously, being one of the most horrific examples, but Saginaw and many of the other communities part of that as well. So I would love it, personally, if Denise, if you would allow Denise to speak a little bit about Saginaw as sort of a case study, because while Saginaw only has 3 schools closing as opposed to 24, Saginaw is also not as big of a community as Detroit, and especially when you consider where in a state city like Saginaw those schools are closed. But I'll let Denise talk about that if she would.
One of the significant impacts in Saginaw is that we border the Buena Vista School District, which was dissolved in 2013. It was one of 2 districts, Inkster being the other, that the governor and the state dissolved because of their financial struggles. And so when those districts, when they dissolved, Saginaw received the students that came from Buena Vista. And so we have the impact that would be felt if the schools that Natasha Baker has recommended for closure, if those schools were to close, they would also impact students who had been transferred there when their district, as a result of their district being dissolved. And Saginaw is a very segregated city divided by a river. The west side of our city is the predominantly Caucasian side, and the east side is predominantly African American. And over the course of the past 10 years or so, we've seen 2/3 of the schools on the east side in the neighborhoods that are going to be the higher poverty level, 2/3 of those schools have been closed, whereas compared to the west side, where only 1/3 have been closed. And it just so happens that the recommendations that Natasha has made for closure, again, fall on the east side. So it's a total, a total blow to that community, removing the resources, causing a quick downward spiral of the neighborhoods. You know, you can drive around and all you see are abandoned school buildings. I see more abandoned schools before I get to one that actually has schools in them when I'm driving on the east side of Saginaw. And without knowing, you know, the decision that they've made, they have not been to Saginaw. They have not been into the schools that they're recommending for closure. They've not met with the students and the families and the community. And so they are further devastating, communities that are barely hanging on. There's not even a major grocery store on the east side of Saginaw. And, you know, that's a blow that we just recently took. And to be threatened with the loss of our high school and one of the elementary schools that feeds into it is just, you know, it's highly problematic.
You know, what you both have said today, Tom and Denise, it puts in mind for me actually just a continuity from the Obama administration. Same problem existed, existed under Obama. Same issues about the qualifications of the person who would be Secretary of Education. The same issues about the shift to charter schools. So is this an exaggeration or misinterpretation, or is it not exactly or pretty much the same policies just having just being executed by a different face?
Well, I think that on the one hand, this is moving in an even worse direction. On the other hand, I think underlying your point, Utris, is there are a lot of folks who would really like to whitewash the history of how we got to the point that a Betsy DeVos could be considered even nominally acceptable. And that is through a lot of Democratic collusion with educational privatizers. You know, as you're pointing out, I mean, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations have been an absolute wrecking ball to the public education sector. And Arne Duncan was in many ways the worst that we've seen so far. And, you know, that you see the trace of that both nationally and locally. So locally, it's tough for some of us to watch as the CEO of the Skillman Foundation, Tanya Allen, is quoted in national news outlets saying that, you know, calling out Betsy DeVos for her destruction in Detroit. I'm happy to see Betsy DeVos called out that way. But the fact of the matter is that mainstream neoliberal democratic oriented organizations like the Skillman Foundation have been utterly complicit in the destruction that has been wrought on Detroit for quite some time. So, you know, just to quickly mention some of those sins as we get closer to Ash Wednesday, I guess. The Skillman Foundation in 2010 rolled out Excellent Schools Detroit and declared with that rollout that their position was that the elected school board should be disbanded, that there should be a single point of accountability vested in the mayor, and when they didn't get the mayor, they were very happy to pony up to the emergency manager, that Detroit should have a New Orleans, Louisiana-style recovery school district, which became the Education Achievement Authority, and that parents should be induced to see test scores as reflective of what made a school good and were to reject some schools and choose others based on those criteria. So, you know, part of what has made the far right be able to ascend as it has is the fact that they were close partners to mainstream neoliberal organizations over these past many years. And those organizations now want to say, oh my gosh, it's so horrible that we have Betsy DeVos. But she's not that different from what they represented. And that's one of the points that I continue to return to all the time, is to point out, you know what? Democrats helped make the horrible circumstances that we're in. Jennifer Granholm, Democratic governor, appointed the first emergency manager, Robert Bob, to Detroit public schools. And so what we really need to have is not just a sense of kumbaya around rejecting Betsy DeVos, but calling out those who, at least calling out a process of truth and reconciliation about the terrible collaboration with neoliberal privatizers in decimating our urban public schools. This is only the final chapter now. The rest of the book has been written largely by Democratic collaborators.
Ross Belland is an expert on the DeVos family. He also knows about the role of the religious far right in this move to privatize education, and he joins us now. Thank you, Russ, for being with us today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Happy to help.
Thanks. You're on with Tom Pedroni and Denise Baldwin. Could you describe what you think is this vigorous effort and the speed, which is, these are one thing, but I wanted to ask about the specific choice of Betsy DeVos. What do you think it is that she specifically was chosen from, I imagine, more than enough of a pool of people who could have been better candidates?
Yes. I think, first of all, she had a relationship with Mike Pence, who was governor, worked with the DeVos-funded and created Great Lakes Education Project. They had, before her name was announced, she and Pence had dinner together. Then she offered, I think, to the sensibilities of Donald Trump, a large campaign donation, $9.5 million. Two, that she was going to, you know, tear things up. And, you know, for somebody who wants to posture himself as an anti-establishment Republican, she fit the bill. You know, we're gonna tear up public education, and you know, Donald Trump is nothing if he doesn't smell a dollar somewhere. The possibility of making money, Trump University being one example. So I think all of those things led to her. And, you know, and I couldn't prioritize which one was first, but I do think Pence plays more of a role in this than people generally appreciate.
Considering that she has admitted, at least when the nomination process was going on, she was participating at the in the hearings, of course, and it was a hugely disappointing showing, so much so that I think she felt relieved that they would delay the hearing a bit so that she can gather herself. Considering that she admitted to having zero experience in education policy and in education administration, do you suspect that she will be taking cues and directives from somebody else or someplace else? And what do you suspect that might be?
Well, I think her family has been pretty fixed on where they're going for a long time. In the mid-90s, I wrote about their plans to use charter schools to help dismantle public education and then use the base of charter education to push for constitutional amendments, in this case in the Michigan Constitution, to create vouchers. At some point after the success of that voucher amendment to the Constitution, the charter schools would turn into private school, completely private, and they wouldn't be charters anymore. They dump the facade of pretending that they're a public academy, become private schools, and live off of the vouchers, and you know, disestablish the instrumentalities of public education in the state of Michigan.
So this would kind of pattern itself after the formation of companies outside of, let's say, the military, where the DeVos family is linked to companies that provide, say, secret services and military services, and as a kind of training camp that could relieve the burden of the government in assuming both the responsibility and the cost of maintaining those kinds of services within the established military. We're going to find the school system, the privatized school system, following that same pattern.
Well, I think if you're suggesting that they would see the schools constituted as a more as centers of indoctrination for youth, that's clearly true. But it would. I think what was primary was that they were going to they wanted private Christian schools getting the voucher money, and they were going to Christianize education, and that was more fundamental to their mission, I think, than anything. so that, you know, they have a relationship, for instance, with the National Heritage Academies, which is a multi-state charter chain based out of Western Michigan. And that's what they, when they started their charters, that's exactly how they operated. They had to go through in religious indoctrination as well as, you know, 20 minutes of singing patriotic songs and so forth every day in their classrooms. They were challenged about the religious part of it, and they toned it down. But that's kind of the model that that the DeVosses see coming to, into being. And so once they convert from charters to private schools that get vouchers, you know, the chains are off, and they can indoctrinate as they see fit. And the DeVosses have made clear that that's where they intend to go.
I want to ask this, just whoever is first at it, fine. What is wrong about charter schools? What is the actual danger that charter schools pose? And isn't it really kind of natural that parents who don't know very much of the background of these schools would opt for charter schools because the quality of education in their communities available to them is just not up to par? So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. If charter schools appear to be offering discipline and, you know, less crowded classrooms, a curriculum that would help them achieve, can they be blamed for going that route and being actually proponents of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the the responsibility has to be on allowing the conditions of public schools and pushing and creating the conditions of public schools where they're seen as less effective as institutions of education. The state, and since I came in late, I'm sure this has been covered, but the state has controlled the Detroit schools for 15 years, and it was a target of the DeVosses going back to the 1990s, that Detroit public schools be phased out of existence. when the state took over in 1999, there was no academic justification, there was no financial justification, there was no leadership governance justification. It's strictly about money and pushing the dismantling of the school district. And they did it because they simply had a partisan majority that was anti-Detroit. Once they took it over, all the positive indicators of the school district started going negative. They tore apart the Detroit public schools over the last 18 years. But this governor and the previous two governors, Jennifer Granholm and John Engler. And so the only thing I would challenge parents and citizens on is the toleration that allowed this to occur. There was always resistance. There was always fight back, but not enough. And again, you know, at the state level, even the Democratic Party participated in this, and it's a disgrace.
So what do you see next as important to happen? What should happen right now?
The governance has be returned to Detroiters, just like every school district in the state of Michigan does in their respective communities. Two, Michigan needs to adopt an adequate funding model for public education. Even the governor's own appointed commission on this said that they are underfunding public education in the state of Michigan. School districts do close, not just in Detroit, but all over the state and in the suburbs and so forth. Then the community has the responsibility of working with their re-empowered school board and with adequate funding to make sure that the focus is on rebuilding the education that the state of Michigan and its collaborators in the charter and privateering world helped destroy.
Denise, what do you think should be happening right now?
I agree with those things that Russ said. In Saginaw, it's a bit different. We still have control. Our local control has not been taken. We have not been under emergency management. We've just been under state influence. I think that currently the way the state reform office is operating is absolutely intolerable, and it needs to be the process that they're on right now with these closures needs to be halted because it has it's been rolled out haphazardly, and it's not an authentic and true process whatsoever. And it helps to further break down our school system. It causes, you know, when we talk about charters and what's wrong with them, one of the things I feel is wrong with them is that they're not really a choice. In some cases, it's been the only thing that was left in the neighborhood after their regular public schools had been closed or destabilized by some of the things that have happened statewide. And so the school would close, and then a charter operator would be there ready to pounce in and take the students that were displaced.
And I was referring to the fact that people in such a position unwittingly will become, you know, proponents of charter schools because that's all they know in a situation where charter schools are the oldest schools available. Unwittingly, they become part of the propaganda that the charter schools are doing just fine. Tom, what do you think should be happening right now?
Well, I agree with what the others have said. I think that both Denise and Russ sort of named off the very things that I would agree with. Return to local democratic governance, which was taken away under what I think are white supremacist premises that very much are along the lines of a traditional colonialist model that said that those who were taking over, who were mostly white, were trying to benefit most the black children who were being poorly served by the electoral choices of their parents. But what it was really about was the extraction of resources, very much a colonizer model. So I think that the local control has to be returned, that to the degree that Detroit is a black city or Saginaw is, that black voting rights and democratic sovereignty needs to be defended. That, as Russ said, the state has now paid for an adequacy study which tells us what we would need, and it does vary district by district because districts have different needs according to the population they serve. We have one of the highest concentrations of childhood poverty in the so-called industrialized world and don't seem to view it as a problem. That rate is over 26% nationally and over 60% in Detroit, from what I understand. Maybe Saginaw is similar as well. That those cities will need greater support because we're not providing justice in other arenas. We need to do it through the educational arena to make kids have a chance to be effective learners. And then we need the citizens to be mobilized. They need to be like the folks who work with Denise in Saginaw. And I think that your question about charters, Saginaw is a really important case study, again, in how insidious the effect of charters is, especially when you have the coercion of the state, which may not have imposed emergency management, but there's the implied threat of it, or you even have educational actors who don't have the best interest of children in mind who use the possible threat of state takeover to try to justify things that are in their own interest. So if I understand the Saginaw context correctly, there have been people who are involved in the leadership of the district who quite possibly were themselves benefiting from the potential charterization of the entry of charters who are even in favor of building closures, at least initially, that would have allowed greater entree to charters. I wonder if we still have time, if Denise, if you could speak to that, because I think Saginaw
is
very
actually, we're out of time, but here's what I would love to do, round you up again as a panel, especially to answer listeners' questions, but it was important to at least react to the confirmation of Betsy DeVos today, and we can make an arrangement to get back to the subject as soon as you're available. All right. But I want to thank you, Tom, Thomas Petroni, Russ Ballant, and Denise Baldwin for being available to us today and being so generous with your time and with your knowledge. And we will resume, hopefully very soon, on the topic. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that brings us to the end of the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, you don't want to miss it, is the NDC Savings Club. Keep that money in your pocket. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories@gmail.com. Thanks so much for being with us today. I hope it was important to you. It certainly is important to me. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.